Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one to ask a question. I would like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Lita Beninson. Thank you, ma'am. You may begin.
Thank you, and welcome to the National Science Foundation to the Data Science Seminar Series that we host here. My name is Lita. I am a AAAS Fellow. I'm serving in the Science Directorate, and we are very lucky today to have Dana Boyd join us from the Data and Society. Data and Society organization. And I can tell you already it's going to be a fantastic and very provocative discussion. And since I knew that there was going to be a lot of interest from the audience on Dana's talk, we've decided to make this a very short presentation and more of a fireside chat event. And so I'm going to let our fireside chat moderator, Heng Zhu, introduce Dana Boyd. But before I do that, I just want to let you know that we have another speaker lined up for January 28th, and it is Michael Jordan. And I know exactly what you're thinking, and the answer is yes. The Michael Jordan from Berkeley, a professor, thought leader in data science. So he will be joining us on the 28th of January. I hope that you will be able to come and attend, and we'll do something very similar as well with a very short presentation and a fireside chat as well. And with that, I'd like to hand this over to Heng for the introduction.
Thank you. It's my great honor to introduce our speaker, Dana Boyd, here. And I feel it's an extremely challenging task because I can use one semester to develop a course on Dana's work and to talk about her research impact. But I only have 1 to 2 minutes, so I'm going to try. So to me, the very first understanding of Dana, she's a great scholar. Her official title is all the following: principal researcher at Microsoft Research and visiting professor at New York City. She completed her PhD at the School of Information at the University of California, Berkeley, and she did her master's degree at the MIT Media Lab and her bachelor's degree in computer science at Brown University. She has written many papers and books on topics related to social media, privacy, teen drama, digital back channels, and social visualization design. And more recently, she has turned to focus on the social and cultural dimensions of the big data phenomenon. Back to the year of the 2013, she founded the research institute, which is named as the Data and the Society, which is a research institute focused on the social and cultural issues arising from the data-centric, you know, activities and technological developments. And in addition to these so many wonderful, you know, achievements in her career, she's also an active blogger. I encourage you to Google her and follow her on her blog. And per my personal knowledge, she's also a mom, a great mother, to two young kids. Back to summer, Dana and I met at a conference, and we had a, you know, conversation about this work-life balance because I was asking Dana, how you manage to do everything. And as a privacy scholar myself, I won't share with you that conversation because Dana shared her answer to me in the context of interpersonal, you know, conversation. So I was not supposed to violate that boundary expectation because we are all privacy scholars. But I encourage you to ask that question if you really want to know the answer at the end of her talk. So let's welcome Dana Boyd to share her understanding and knowledge on making sense of found data.
Hi there. It's an absolute delight to be here with you today. So my goal is to give you some brief thinking of some of my work and how I come at these issues, and then to go into the fireside chat that Heng mentioned. I'm going to begin with a quote from Jeff Bowker, a colleague and friend of mine, because I think it's a really important sort of reminder that, you know, raw data is an oxymoron and a bad idea. To the contrary, data should be cooked with care. big data has become a completely fetishized concept, and in some ways we can talk about it, you know, in terms of what it means technically, in terms of what it's motivating, in terms of data collection, data use, data analysis. But I would argue that in some ways what's most important about big data is its mythology. It's the idea that in many ways that if we just collect more data, somehow we can solve all the world's problems. And because of that, we have seen a whole set of vaporware pop up, things that don't actually really exist but promise to solve things. We've seen a whole set of moves in different dimensions where people are trying to bring data into their organizations and organizations that don't make sense to have data brought in. At the same time that we have seen a through line of very important technical innovation, technical advancement, and important critical analyses. And so because of that, we have to sort of work through what we're talking about at any given point. What's at stake in data analysis more often than not is the interpretation of it. As we sort of think through, data don't speak for themselves, but the process of collecting, cleaning, combining, analyzing, and interpreting data introduce all sorts of biases, misunderstandings, complexities. And even if we can get the data analysis sort of at a technical level right, if we don't actually know the meaning-making that we're doing, if we don't understand the limitations of our data, if we don't understand the limitations of our statistics, we can do all sorts of really problematic things with data. And this is one of the reasons why this hype can be really costly, because as we work on technical advancements, if we don't have a sense for what's going on socially, we're going to see this thing splinter in a whole set of different directions. I'm going to back up and give you a funny story. I'm going to tell you a funny story that in many ways is pre, you know, big data as we think about it, but a lot of what I think about of data analytics and a lot of the hype of present comes from the idea of social data. And as social media sites, which I studied for a long time, were popping up, I was regularly asked to comment on what I was seeing surrounding a lot of social media. And about a decade ago, I was sitting on a marketing panel. I don't know why I was on a marketing panel. I'm a really bad person to put on a marketing panel, so I was really confused. But the representative from Coca-Cola was loudly talking about how beloved they were on all social media, how they had found social media to be the future of all their marketing campaigns, and they were very much espousing to others that this should be their future too. And he was talking about how Coca-Cola was the most loved friend all over. At the time, it was MySpace. And I burst out laughing. Not a good way to make friends. So the moderator turns to me with a scornful look and is just like, you know, why do you think this is so funny? And I was like, I had noticed the disproportionate attention that Coca-Cola had gotten on social media. And so I sort of dove into it, and I hate to tell the representative, but that's not the Coke people are talking about. And this is a classic moment of misunderstanding, right, which is that people had, you know, young people had learned to manipulate all sorts of different kinds of social media to use Coke as a symbolic reference for the sortable kind, to have sorts of interesting conversations about references to whether or not certain musicians were using the sortable kind, different issues around this. But they had become a part of encoded language that had made the data very dirty. And a lot of it that I came to was realizing that young people were messing with data, that is found data all the time. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but I'm going to give you one example from all of this. I'm going to tell you the story of Carmen. For those who I talked to earlier, I apologize for the repetition. Carmen is a young woman of Argentinian descent, and what's really important is that she has an extended network on social media. At the time of this interview, Facebook was actually cool with young people, so this is going to refer to Facebook. I warn you, that is no longer the case. But for Carmen, her extended family was all in Argentina was all on Facebook, alongside all of her friends from school. Whenever she would try to speak to her family, she would speak in Spanish. Whenever she would try to speak to her friends at school, she would speak in English. She knew her family understood English, she knew her friends understood Spanish, but they really got that this was a separate code-switching process. She had separated her world effectively this way. Problem was her mother. Anybody who's spent time with teenagers knows that the mother is the person that everybody has to complain about over and over again. Carmen was no different. And the problem with her mother is that whenever she would post comments on Facebook, her mother would comment on them, and this caused massive problems because, as noted, everyone just kind of disappears after the mom posts. Deeply problematic. So Carmen's in a situation. She and her boyfriend have just broken up. She wants to tell all of her friends what's happening because she really wants the love, the support, the validation, the feedback, classic reason in which young people use social media. She knows that if she posts something deeply emotive, her mother will comment on it. Her mother will think she's depressed and suicidal. It's happened before. It's a bit of a problem. So she's trying to find a way to let her friends know what's going on about the situation while not tipping off her mother. Now, she is a 17-year-old. She is therefore trying to express something emotionally. She's looking for the perfect song lyric because all emotions are to be expressed in song lyrics. And so what she does is figure out a song that her mother won't recognize but her friends will. Now, the irony of this is I love this story because it's so geeky. It's not necessarily exemplar of all teens. But she knows that her mother won't know British cultural references, but her friends who had recently seen a movie will. So she posts song lyrics from Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Now, if you are not that geeky, this is a song sung during the life of Brian when the key character is being crucified. There is nothing happy about this actual scene in this film. It's a Monty Python film. There's nothing happy. But the song sounds so positive, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Indeed, she posts this. Her mother immediately comments, it looks like you're having a great day. And her friends immediately text her. Right? This is encoding. I talk about this as social steganography in my work, which is the notion of hiding in plain sight. It is a very powerful tool of making certain that people can see things only if they have the information necessary to make meaning of it. It's a song lyric. Any sort of, you know, a parser can tell you that it's a song lyric we can recognize. But you don't know the meaning, you don't know the reference, you don't know what's going on unless you are in the context. And indeed, what I saw is that young people were finding more and more sophisticated ways to do this. They have different terms for it, things like subtweeting, which is about these different layers where you don't know what's going on. I will see tons of content with young people where it's like, oh my God, can you believe it? She said, I know, like Friday night, yeah. You know, what just happened there? And they know exactly who's referencing, what the drama is, what the situation. They can decode all of that because they're trying to make sense of it. At the same time, they know they're messing with algorithms. And it's their messing with algorithms that I spend a lot of time having fun with that are then sort of lead us into this. So I started seeing posts like this on Facebook for a while. What you up to, Nike? I'm bored. What does Nike have to do with anything? What young people had worked out, accurately or not, does not matter, is that Facebook had limited what you could see in the news feed. You were not seeing everything. They didn't know why. They didn't know what would make it happen. But they knew that certain things seemed to trigger the likelihood that their friends would see their posts. In particular, they noticed that putting brand names in the middle of a post would be more likely to make certain it would be received by their friends in the newsfeed algorithm. So all of a sudden, you saw brand names all over kids' posts, and you're like, why? And they were trying to think about whatever brands they thought might attract Facebook's attention. And they were messing with the algorithm in order to do what they were trying to do, in order to socialize. Meanwhile, of course, these companies are putting a ton of ad dollars against this, thinking that, like, clearly Nike is the most important thing. This is not the only way in which they were doing this. You know, one of my favorite examples that I saw of young people was when they were trying to mess with Gmail accounts. Nothing is funnier if you're 15 than diapers ads. So what they would do is try to make messages where they would trigger diapers ads on their friends' ads, right? And again, messing with the data. This is where you're starting to see algorithmic awareness, the moment in which the algorithm feeds things back and plays with them. And this is where you start to see them trying to have some sort of control over it at the same time that it's completely muddying the data that we're talking of, and that is sort of found and natural. Now, the challenge with a lot of this comes down to the interpretation. What's at stake is, like, whether or not Nike is actually relevant. Clearly, this young person knows enough about Nike to put Nike as a brand in there. The brand has already had work. In some ways, this is advertising. That's important. But what are the consequences of that interpretation? What happens when that's even accurate, right? How many of you know the story of Target that's been in the newspapers? It should be the majority of the room. Okay, I'm going to give the story since not everybody knows it. I warn you ahead of time, this is probably apocryphal, which is one of the reasons why it's a really interesting story to look at, because it's been used to shape a lot of discourse. As the story goes, I should back up before the story. The thing to know is that when in the advertising world, the most important time that you can target somebody is at the point of their pregnancy. After a child's birth, they will actually, the first child's birth, I should say, they will change all of their purchasing patterns for the next 10 to 15 years. It is one of the most critical times, and so data analytics have long been used to identify when somebody is likely to give birth. You are all required to report in the United States to state records when you actually have a child, and in the 6 months afterwards, it's like an onslaught of snail mail that comes from that. But people have tried to back up, try to get ahead of that, because it's the pregnancy that matters. So when you register for marriage, depending on your zip code, you can actually predict likelihood of first birth. There's a lot of work that has been done to try to harness this. Facebook has become much more sophisticated at it, all, et cetera, et cetera. But Target argues that they could figure it out better than anybody else. And one of the things they did was look at when people were buying diapers and try to back it up 9 months, right? The first diapers purchased, back it up. Can you figure out what practices changed? And what they found was that first trimester, there's a lot of different changes in a woman's purchasing patterns. Unscented hand lotion and vitamins, not even prenatals, but just regular vitamins, were the biggest trigger of change. And so as the story goes, they started, you know, analyzing this and trying to give advertisements out to people who had some of these demographic shifts in what they were doing. So the story goes that they send out adverts to all of these homes. One of them went to the home of a 16-year-old whose father was irate, calls up Target and says, how dare you tell my daughter that she should be having a baby, of course, the customer service person can't even respond to this, ends up being like, I must call you back, manager, help. And in the process, the manager calls back a few days later, and as the story goes, the father says, there are things that have happened in my household that I don't know about. Basically, as the story goes, Target had figured out that this girl was pregnant before her father. Now, again, it is not entirely clear the accuracy of this. What is clear is that Target spent a lot of time trying to deal with the cleanup of this New York Times article, my favorite of which is a new technique that I've seen in beautiful ways, which is that I live in a zip code in the middle of Manhattan that is clearly has a density that does not involve grass. I get lawnmower ads. Right? There is no reason in which I should get lawnmower ads. But as I started looking at analysis of what people were seeing, what I started realizing is that people were getting ads for things that were intentionally wrong mixed with things that were probabilistically accurate. Right? That's a really sophisticated way of responding to this, and indeed we started to see all of these different moments. So where is creepy? It's creepy when there's a moment of accuracy, or when it's the moment of accuracy in order to convince you that it's not accurate, right? Like, where is that edge case? How do we deal with that? That's one of the challenges that we see, because even when you can get more accurate, what kind of work are you doing? What are the ways in which you're building trust and reputation? I want to give another case study. This is from the work of Mike Anani, who's a professor at the University of Southern California. He was doing some work on Grindr, which is a gay male location dating service, and he went to download the app on his Android phone. I was really fascinated by the recommendation system that came up. And the first recommendation, for those who can't read it, is for sex offender search. Now, if you're not fluent in the politics in the United States about the association between gay men and sex offenders, this is an extraordinarily fraught conversation, where one of the political moves has been to argue that gay men are inherently sex offenders, that sex offenders are inherently gay, and that correlation is one of the reasons that we should be banning marriage and other such moves to legitimize gay rights. So this is an extremely interesting moment. Why did this happen? He wrote this up in The Atlantic, and he asked that question. Now, anybody who's done any recommendation work can sort of start to untangle this. It's like, maybe it has to do with similar geography of wanting both of these applications or both of these apps on the phone. Maybe it's a similar population. That would be really strange. Maybe there's something about the text or the description of the app. Maybe there's some correlation that is done using third-party data analytics, given the fact that we actually have a cultural bias around the association between these two. We don't know. What we know is that for some reason, this was the most strongly recommended next app to download. And indeed, when he wrote this article, hoping that he would get an explanation of how this algorithmic work had been done, Google responded by simply removing the correlation. right? And we see this as coming up all the time. We can find these correlations. This one is so visible to us because it has a huge cultural resonance. It is, has cost. It has ramifications. But what are those small, subtler ones? What are the ones where we go, ooh? And what are the ways in which we see these things being learned? So, for example, LaTanya Sweeney, I don't know how many of you know her work. She's a computer scientist out of Harvard. She was sort of interested when she searched for her name that she kept finding things that would say, oh, LaTanya, criminal record, question mark. She'd be like, what? What is that about? So she did a big analysis, a big study, and found that historically black names in the United States come up with unbelievable likelihood that they're going to get these questions of criminal records and all sorts of criminal justice-related products, and this is not true for notoriously white names in the United States. And she was like, what's going on here? Now, as a computer scientist, being able to talk within the technical team, she could figure this out. And what she figured out really quickly is that this is a learning algorithm. Now, for some reason, when people were searching for black names, they were more likely to click on the ads that were originally presented uniformly, regardless of race of name, or they were distributed across all names. But when people were searching for black names, they were more likely to click on them. Hence, it learned. It learned the correlation. In other words, Google did a phenomenal job of feeding back at us our very racist society. So what are the consequences of these recommendation systems, of these learning algorithms, where they're doing the interpretation of the biases within our society and feeding them back at us, reifying them, and creating new challenges for us? Privacy is not simply the control of information. It is the control of a social situation. And controlling a social situation is extremely hard when you're dealing with a lot of these network data ecosystems, where your data is not just about you, it's not about individual control, it's about the way it feeds out and fuels and is being a part of a larger connected society. And the way that I've been thinking about this a lot lately is that how that data it becomes part of the found data ecosystem really matters. We often assume that, you know, this is all like contributions. People just sort of excited to contribute, and if they're not, they should just have privacy and disappear. But I started to realize that the data in our ecosystem tends to come from three different realms. There is data that is acquired or part of the found data system because it was produced by choice, by circumstance, and by coercion. By choice is what we all want to hope for, right? People want to participate. They want to contribute. There are those of us who are, like, tracking all of our data because it's really cool. We want to learn about ourselves. Yay, kumbaya, data, revolution, awesome. That is not the majority of the world, right? The majority of the world is actually living in a data-by-circumstance situation. They're just sort of sitting there being like, I really hope that the people I give my data to are trusted because I really just want to share photos with my friend on Instagram because that's awesome, right? Most people don't want to think about the broader ecosystem because they just want to be a part of something social. And that data by circumstance reality is one of the reasons why you can't get people all excited about privacy, because they're just sitting there hoping that this will not become a problem. And all they care about is the ability to socialize, interact, play, have fun. These are the folks in the majority of the population. But a lot of us who are trying to grapple with these challenges are trying to deal with the folks who are at the coercive end of things. The coercive end are the people whose data is contributed to databases not because they want to, but because they are required to, for a whole set of different reasons. I've been spending a lot of time dealing with incarceration-related issues and policing. How many of you know about spit and acquit programs in the U.S.? So spit and acquit programs are one of the fastest ways in which we are getting genetic material in the U.S. faster than any scientific program, which is that there was a ruling a couple of years ago at the Supreme Court called Maryland versus King, which ruled that collecting genetic material at the point of arrest is equivalent to collecting a photograph or a fingerprint. It is considered to be a unique identifier, and it is completely justified by law. As a result, the major police districts in the United States have been collecting massive databases about genetic material, all for the promise of forensics, except that they've started to figure out that they can do network analysis about this. Indeed, LAPD has done a phenomenal job of showing up at people's houses, being like, you're related to this suspect, where is he? Only people, they're showing up at people's houses that didn't even know they had a brother, which is always an interesting dynamic. But spit and acquit is a very specific sub-program of all of this. Orange County has mastered this to a brilliant level. Spit and acquit is when people are pulled over for minor traffic violations or other activities, and they are told that if they will provide genetic material, they will not actually be fined. something that we see all over this country. So it's one of the ways in which we are building out huge databases, not surprisingly, of black and brown individuals, because that is what our policing ecosystem looks like in the United States. So what does it mean that some of our largest genetic databases in the United States are happening under policing ecosystems? For those who aren't following a lot of genetics-related laws, one of the things that's intriguing is that I've just ripped genetics all over here, and all of you have the complete right to come and pick it up and swab it and do whatever you want with it. Right? We don't do any level of protection around this. And what we can do analytically around this is only just beginning. So I point this out because there's a whole world in which we are seeing data being coerced and data being found in combination and collision to one another. Data being coerced is also one of the things we see in almost all of our social services programs, where we're requiring more and more data being collected to perform legitimacy of why you're actually sharing that data. You know, here at the NSF, some of the most statistical or some of the most rigorous statistical folks and thoughtful computer scientists are feeding into the world of data science in a brilliant way. But the same techniques that we're seeing sort of analyzed and challenged here, we're seeing performed out in a variety of different fields with a lot more variable practices. And we're seeing a lot of promises that are statistically invalid, inaccurate, and impossible. I've been looking a lot, for example, at personalized learning, which is the public frame of something that we often talk about as adaptive learning in more technical realms. If you look at what personalized learning is promising, for right now, almost all of it is vaporware. The reason I bring this up to you is that Gates and now Mark Zuckerberg have just promised how many billions of dollars to figure out what we're going to do around personalized learning, except that we don't even have the data to make sense of this or a promise that we're going to treat this data well. The long history of data and education in the United States has been extraordinarily coercive, which is one of the reasons why low-income populations do everything possible to muck with that data and why you see a lot of resistance to it in those communities. So how do we think with this? I want to highlight that a huge chunk of what we do statistically is about discriminating. And I don't mean discriminating in the 1960s and forward sensibility. I mean the historical sense, which is about separating one population from the other. That is the basis of insurance. That is the basis of things like financial scoring. That is the basis of a lot of statistical analysis, which is at the cornerstone of what we're talking about around data. The challenge is that as we do that kind of formalized mechanisms of discrimination, of segmenting, of clustering, we are also producing discrimination in the much more 1960s and forward sense, except that it's not going to always be in the legal sensibility of being about protected classes. It's going to be about separating and segmenting populations with huge social consequence, but with little consideration for that social consequence. So, you know, before we go over into the conversation, the thing I want you to sort of sit with and remember is that in order for this big data phenomenon to go from hype to something that is valuable, we need to be thinking through not just the technical possibilities, but the socio-technical, the ways of understanding the social implications of this, because as these things roll out, they're not going to be used in all of the ways in which they were designed for. It's not going to be simply what a grad student, at Cal is going to do, in terms of a really awesome machine learning algorithm. It's going to be how it gets deployed by people who do not understand anything about statistics, and then how it's going to be interpreted when we see that data be funneled into it without any consideration of the biases of that data set. We are already seeing this in predictive policing in a really obvious sense, but it is a real social consequence because as we invest in these technologies, we need to invest in the social considerations of them. Thank you.
I have a couple of slides. I have a privilege to ask the very first question, and then the audience will just follow up with hundreds of questions for you. We truly enjoy your talk, which is very inspiring, and I'm asking a question on behalf of my toddler because I'm worrying his future, when he grew up as a teenager after 10 or 15 years. I'm asking this question because I have been amazed by how many smart toys have been surrounding him, as a 21-month-old toddler, right? All those toys can capture the data and can send the data to the toy makers and other third parties. And recently we watched the news, the VTech data breach, which is a, giant toy maker in this country. And the data breach, the stolen data from children include their names, gender, and birth date.
So this actually worries me, and I brought this, you know, this on my hand. I'm having this, you know, smart, beautiful Barbie. And now you can get this smart Barbie with less than $80, or sometimes on discount you can get it less than $50. And this smart Barbie uses voice recognition technique to understand what a child is saying and trying to record and respond that conversation. And based on my understanding and research, the conversation between a child and his Barbie not only sent back to the, you know, toy maker, but also stored on third-party databases. And as a parent, I'm so concerned that my child's conversation with this cute Barbie doll will be recorded, analyzed, and potentially shared with a lot of third-party and advertisers, right? And then due to the low cost of this data storage, it's getting very popular practice for today's business, including, you know, toy makers, to collect as much information as possible from the users and their customers. And we all believe that big data comes with the big responsibility for ensuring appropriate privacy guarantees for our, you know, citizens. So my question for you is that for our future smart toys, for our toddlers, right, nowadays, and smart homes that we are going to live with, smart cities, how may we better architect our future intelligent systems, applications, devices for better privacy? Yeah. We often talk about privacy by design, and relate back to your first part of the conversation about teenagers, right, how we can better architect the privacy by design for today or tomorrow's teenagers. So that's my selfish question asking for my toddler.
Absolutely. I'm going to use a mic because, as you can probably tell, my voice is a little wacky. I'm going to try not to scream. One of the challenges for me is that children are a strange character in all of this. They are both vulnerable and exploratory in all sorts of interesting ways. And parents get up in arms to try to protect them in all sorts of interesting ways. As a result, we have created a whole set of privacy legislation that specifically targets young people as uniquely vulnerable populations, which I think is both in some ways warranted, in some ways actually problematic, because it doesn't allow for us to consider the fact that we are equally vulnerable, equally clueless, and least likely to watch what's going on. And we are even, and then the population is probably the most vulnerable is our older citizens in the country. So I point that out there because one of the things is that we're going to see the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act be used in relationship to a lot of this, because there's going to be promises that were made. This is a great case that they can actually pursue. We're going to see a company that violated terms of service, and in some ways, like it's another illegal practice. The challenges for me are where we get to much more nuanced and legal behaviors. So I don't know how many of you have been watching in your fair area. I guess I can't call it your city since it's really across the water, but in your neighboring city, we've seen a lot of new battles over children's, our student privacy coming up, and there's been, 11 different bills proposed in different forms. And as I started diving into what was going on, one of the things that I found, which I thought was really intriguing, is a middle and upper class anxiety that we're going to focus on the consequence of what this means about the possibilities of commercial use of this data. But every single one of those bills has a carve out for criminal justice. Every single one of them allows data to be collected on students for criminal justice related issues. And one of the things that I see in terms of looking at what's happening in the schools, if you go in and look at judicial decision making, huge amounts of judicial decision making right now is deciding based on your historical performance in school, your historical attendance records in school, and all the disciplinary related issues within school are determining your first moment with the judge, whether or not you will get bail and how long you will actually be sentenced. I bring this up because it's one of the things that we often miss when we come from a world where we think so much about the commercial aspects of things. And we are, of course, fueling a mass incarceration epidemic in this country through a lot of these different moves. I bring this up because it's one of those moments where we have had longstanding bias in history going into this. Where I look at it in the commercial realm is that, one of the things that I see is the companies that are not really honest about what they're doing will eventually have to face repercussions, legal repercussions, social repercussions in different ways, especially when they go into sensitive areas like families. Where I'm much more concerned is what happens with the companies that are not actually as well known, the third-party data brokers who actually start to move that data in different ways. The risky data for me is not in many ways the things that we would classically talking about as PII. It's in many ways the conversational information. It's the networked information. Networks are probably more consequential as a privacy-related matter than anything about your area of, or your actual address. We assume address is one of the most important because the thing is that you can find where somebody is, and our risk model, our theoretical risk model, is actually much more about the idea of using it to come and abduct you or harm you or rob you, et cetera, et cetera. This is actually not the biggest risk that people face. The biggest risk that people face is that they will be written out of opportunities within the society. And the way that they are written out of opportunities within society is because of their network. So, for example, you're already seeing this in terms of large numbers of company in a verbal sense. If you try to apply for many different companies, even in technical fields, they'll ask you who else in the company you know. What they're trying to figure out is your network position. They're using this more and more, using LinkedIn data. It's pretty easy to do. Guess what? Discrimination happens beautifully that way, because you see this structural position happening. It actually gets much more sophisticated as we're talking about some of the automated tracking systems that shape whether or not you get jobs. So most of us are used to a world in which we've submitted a resume and may actually get to talk to a human. They may not actually respond to us, especially if anybody's dealt with academic markets. But at the same time, it's actually a human that's looking at this. More and more for working class jobs, it's all done on an automated system. It's all done based on what they can pull in terms of who your network is. So when I look at risk factors, I'm actually far more concerned about the things that we are actually making already visible. The stuff that you all have made visible through social media of who you know, who you connect to, the stuff that your phone has just beaconed off and told everybody that you all know each other. Right? There's so much of that data that we're not actually talking about that I worry. My biggest worry about the privacy conversation is that we get distracted by the worst fears rather than actually the much more systemic elements of them.
Very insightful responses, and also cover so many different perspectives of the design notion, which goes beyond the technical notion of it. So, any questions from the audience?
I see a hand there.
So, you talk about sort of the feedback and what we do with, like, discriminated populations, but you also have sort of the feedback elements themselves already in that, for example, if your school system is saying, oh, well, we've gotten zinged for having too many African Americans showing up in our records, that we will only actually count those a certain percentage of them, and so then you're actually adding to your data in you're degrading your data quality, and you're actually adding to the impact on the person that's not in that protected group.
So one of the funniest things about data is that we don't ever collect it without all the political considerations. It always becomes a feedback loop. Nowhere is this more clear than census, right? Every time we're like, oh, we're going to come up with a perfect instrument for census this year, right? This time we can do it. This time we can figure out how to properly collect information on race, on gender, on all of these other factors. It's like, oh, God, here we go again, right? And part of it is that it becomes extraordinarily political in a feedback loop because we connect. Sorry, I'm going in and out on this. It's because we can. I'm just going to stay. It's because one of the things that happens is that we can see the consequences of it, and then we make the next move. And those next moves are part of that challenge and part of that story. And one of the things we have to figure out how to deal with technically is to design that part of the system. Design for the social gaming and design for, the variability of it. And this is one of the things I love talking to statisticians about, right? Like, because they're really thinking about ranges of quality of data and all of the different realms. And the more that they can understand the social logics behind why people do what they do, the more they can actually make some of those buffers. But a lot of it is also to consider about some of the political decisions. You know, I spend a lot of time with Native Americans, and one of the things you will hear over and over again is that that count for census is going to be what matters for all of the funding for them for the next 10 years. The result of which is that most Native Americans are biracial, but they will never identify as such because it has huge social consequences. So how do we figure out how to architect the data collection process to be recognizing of the politics, and how do we carve off and silence the politics of it because it's dangerous for being able to do a lot of the scientific work? And that's going to be really difficult. The other place where I think that there's a lot of interesting advances and thinking through this is the public health arena. I'm really particularly enamored by a lot of the work that's happened at Columbia around the AIDS epidemic and the politics of trying to collect data during the height of the AIDS epidemic and the just challenges of dealing with all of this. And we keep messing this up and we don't learn from history, and nowhere was that clear than our conversation with Ebola, which was beautifully political, over the last year. But how do we think through that? And that's actually one of the moments where public health should be part of this conversation as we get more into data science. But those conversations right now, for all sorts of organizational reasons, are separated. But, you know, for those of you who are trying to think about it, bring in the public health people. They're really thinking about it in a sophisticated way.
Yeah. Actually, that's a good segue. My name is Joe Bonneville. Thank you for your talk.
My name is Joe Bonneville. I'm a AAAS fellow in Big Data Analytics at USAID, the International Agency for International Development. And I'm actually on the Lab Ebola team. So one of the things that I actually wanted to talk to you about, or ask you to get your kind of your thoughts on, is the opposite side of this. So we see everything that's so scary and the things that can happen. With Hans Rosling and a couple other people, so you look at data and you look at it as a window into somebody's life. You can put together an entire story about their life, whether they need help, whether they don't need help, whether they have a learning disability that can be circumvented. You know, Stanford's doing this study on, you know, taking a look at how people learn, what they're looking at, and being able to facilitate that so that you improve their learning ability. I just wanted to see if you could give me a couple comments on the not so scary side of things.
Part of the reason that I go to the scary is in order to remind us how to think about it in a holistic way, but I think you're totally right. We need to highlight what is very positive and what is opportunistic. And a lot of what is positive and opportunistic is, again, not just because we have technically been able to make sense of something, but because we've been able to wrap a set of politics and decisions around it in a sophisticated way. I'll stick with the biomedical space for a moment because I've been really intrigued by some of the work that Jason Bilb and his team, Jeff Hammerbacher and whatnot, have been doing up at Mount Sinai. For those who aren't familiar with this team, one of the things that they're struggling with is that when you collect data about things, about diseases, you usually collect data from people who are sick, right? So they've died of X, and then you go back and try to do a lot of genetic mapping and try to understand their history. But what about the people who genetically should be predisposed to a particular illness and never got it? How do you find them? And so they did this because some of the biggest advances in AIDS-related research was between that moment for where people who had HIV had a particular genetic mechanism, and this is where I'm going to say this note caveat: I know nothing about biology, so this is me sort of giving their work because I'm really impressed by it. Is that moment where then you could actually see that they should have gotten AIDS, but they actually never did. They never actually went from HIV to AIDS, and that was actually one of the big things that they were able to make an innovation around. So they're now trying to figure out how you actually do full spectrum modeling of populations for genetic makeup for people who are most likely to get ill but don't get ill, in order to see if we can actually do huge disease advances accordingly. I think that this is really important. There's no doubt that the humanitarian space is one of them. Like, the possibility of being able to fast-track move and in a moment of crisis in, you know, a humanitarian disaster and be able to intervene sophisticatedly is phenomenal. But it requires not just the data, but the data being put bureaucratically into an organization that can use it productively without the political backlash. And the challenge there is that there's all sorts of histories of it being used absolutely ineffectively, inefficiently, and basically mundanely, bureaucratically failing. And then, of course, the scary stories are where we go, yikes! And so there's this interesting moment of risk tolerance of how much should we try to advance the opportunities when we recognize that most of it will fail in mundaneness and some percentage of it could get deeply destructive. And that's where I think that there's this interesting challenge, is because we could advance science so much if we would all be willing to start to give over a lot of information. But do we really trust the people who are collecting it? Do we really trust their security? Do we really trust the government? There's been a long history of this being abused in different ways. We could advance so much humanitarianly if we could actually understand large populations, but we can talk about this as a humanitarian issue. What do we deal with when we deal with corrupt regimes? We're not going to treat it as such. Right? And part of it is that, you know, especially from a European sensibility, there's a long history of this. This is what the Netherlands went through in the late 30s and early 40s. Right? They collected data, and it had serious, dire consequences. And so that's where you're seeing a lot of that anxiety, and where I think what we have to figure out is how we have the trade-off. What is the way in which we can do this? What is the way in which we can make it available and give people the sense of security? What are the kinds of brokering of trust? And how do we make certain that it doesn't get abused so that we can actually make that possible? And that's really what's at stake in light of a lot of the possibilities that are actually pretty phenomenal. I think that basically I think medicine and humanitarian are probably the most, you know, high stakes, high opportunity, but also the most likely to have serious dire consequences, which is why I think they're so broad.
I know that Frank has been waiting.
I'm curious your views on the political attack on social media research and social network analysis research, which have been mounted. Attacks, for example, on Filippo Menkhouser's work on the Truthy Project, and just this past week, attacks on John Kleinberg's work on social media research. And I'm not entirely, I mean, these things are being advertised as concerns over frivolous or irrelevant research, but it's not quite clear to me where these things are coming from.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this is classic anti-government. Like, how do we reduce all of y'all's spending? Put money back in the hands of citizens. This elite research thing is like overrated. It doesn't actually get us anywhere. Am I allowed to go on a political rant?
Yeah.
We've got massive downward mobility in white middle class America in the United States right now. We are seeing it as a big pain point. We are going to blame brown people, first and foremost. We have for a long time. And we are going to blame elites on the flip side of it for being the ones who are actually making it, you know, a space for black and brown individuals to succeed. We are seeing that political realm come straight into our election cycle. We are seeing it come straight into your funding debates. We are seeing it straight into the anti-government element of it all. This is an anti-elitism. In a hope that we can actually reclaim a notion of America being great in a very particular ideology that is in some ways extraordinarily racist, extraordinarily xenophobic, and it's about greatness at consequence of others. As we deal with a global dynamic, it's going to get uglier. Our education system is, as a result, most people are not actually interacting with each other. And the weird thing for me about social media, social networks, and the broader realm of this is the way in which we have actually reduced people's network mobility and network connections. So what I mean by this is that two radical shifts have happened over the last decade that are really important. Historically, in the United States, when people went into the military in the U.S., they remixed their networks across the country. They were able to make connections with people from all over different places. And it was one of the biggest network remakings that happened in the country. The other place where it happened in a sophisticated way was at the college level. Two things happened. First, at the military level, what happened was we privatized huge chunks of the military in 2002. When we privatized it, we actually stopped remaking people's networks through military, which actually had a huge impact on working class Americans. It also meant we did not see the kinds of upward mobility that were once assumed by the military, because you didn't actually learn skills as you actually started to see a tiered military structure. The second, which is actually more coming into the social media realm, is that people got to know people on social media in advance of going to college. They stopped remaking their networks at college. So when it used to be that you would show up at the elite institutions in this country and you would be placed in housing in one of the biggest social engineering experiences, and you would remake things. People asked to be rehoused before you even showed up on campus. They maintained and strengthened connections with people in high school through social media, such that they actually didn't remake their ties. We are seeing a decline in people remaking their ties, which is deeply connected to one of the reasons why people are actually not able to understand people that are different. We are also seeing a geographic sort of clamping down in an environment where we don't actually have economic stability to be able to do that in ways. And so we see some possibilities with it, but it's so political. And what that political is about is at the heart of what this election cycle will be. And it's heartbreaking to me because, like, it's easiest to go after things that are social science related. It's easiest to go after the things that are the elite institutions as, like, a waste of our money. Without a recognition of the importance of a lot of basic science around here. I mean, I don't really tell you guys that, but it's one of the things that kills me because it's political. And I can't solve it, and I don't know what to do with it. And, like, I swing between wanting to put my head in the sand and wanting to sort of fight, but I don't know how to fight on this one. And it's also one of those challenges for me because in some ways I feel, you know, in the early days, like, I spent a lot of time in the making of a lot of social media. What we imagined about being able to connect people around the globe was pretty phenomenal. What we thought we could do in those days, in those halcyon days in the Bay, were pretty phenomenal. Like, we really thought it would connect people. The more that I look at what's happening, the more I'm concerned that we screwed up in the other direction. And I don't have enough data to prove that. But I am concerned about what we ended up creating. And it's one of the things that people are trying to understand, and I love it, but that understanding is not valued in this ecosystem right now.
So let's move to this side.
Sorry, that was really up
to them. And then we can accommodate. I have three questions.
Yeah.
Here. One of the interesting things about the internet to me is that it seems that increasingly our social life and our decision making are connected to the internet, which suggests that it's probably increasingly a medium through which we could be manipulated. So if someone wanted to modify our behavior or our thinking and so on, they would modify what we see, what we read, what opportunities we encounter, what the prices of various activities are, so you can get discounts, right? Who our friends might, what friends might be suggested to us on a social media site and so on. So the potential for manipulation is certainly there. Now, whether anyone can actually use that across all these websites is a question mark, although we're seeing an increasing ecosystem for using multiple websites for advertising purposes and so on. So the question then in my mind is, to what extent do you think that the sort of manipulative potential of the internet is going to be exploited, one, and to what extent will the technologies to allow hot button pushing or companies to figure out what our fantasies, needs, and so on are, and then move those around?
So the funny thing is that we've always been manipulated, and probably the people who are most pissed off about the possibility of companies manipulating people are the state and media, who were some of the most active actors in manipulating for a very long period of our history. So I understand they're pissing us about this. What's at stake is that there's a whole game around power. The ability to actually make networks, to build those relationships, this is classic Manuel Castell, is actually where a lot of power resides. And that's one of the challenges of a lot of these new technologies, is they introduce new actors who can reformulate these networks with connections with information, ideas, people, et cetera. We are seeing different kinds of political responses to this. I'm loving Russia. Russia has sort of been a field day. I don't know if any of you have seen Adrian Chan's reporting on some of this. I'm looking at my friend who just got back from Moscow. One of the things that Russia has done a really good job of saying is that rather than trying to manipulate you, control you, limit what you have access to, we will try to put out so much disinformation and misinformation that you can't actually figure out what's real. Awesome. Like, that's pretty phenomenal to watch that play out in a very sophisticated realm. What is also happening is, attempts to lock down and curtail information flows. This is much more, regressive regimes in very sophisticated ways. But it's been one of the challenges. Yes. Facebook could vote elections. I actually think there's enough checks and balances there that I'm not actually that much worried about Facebook compared to a lot of what else is happening in other parts of the world around it. I think the question for me is how do we get people enough engaged to understand different kinds of manipulation? The way that I like to think about it is go back historically. If you haven't read Fred Turner's The Democratic Surround, I strongly recommend it. What Fred Turner did was that he did his first book from counterculture to cyberculture, where he tried to understand what the hippies of the 60s had to do with the origins of the internet in Silicon Valley. And he realized that was not the complete story, and so he walked back in history. And he ended up in the archives looking at a lot of convenings that happened here in this area in an attempt to bring people together in light of Nazi propaganda. The concern that film was going to be a corruptive a media that could actually be used to manipulate and control the population, and a belief that that was what the Nazi regime had been deploying to successfully galvanize the whole system. These were meetings that happened in the 1930s. The group that met together around this are some famous names, including Margaret Mead, including John Cage, including the nascent group at the Museum of Modern Art, which at that time was an education facility, that came together with it was not actually the Department of Defense at the time, but it was basically a predecessor of it, to really imagine a democratic media. And they actually set forth the research agenda that is at the core of a lot of what ended up becoming a part of DARPA and everything else. It is a beautiful book going through that history, but it is a beautiful book in light of your question, which is that a lot of what has happened as we think about these things is not just what are the architectures that are managed and who are in power control, but what is the information that the public needs in order to grapple with it. One of the things that was argued in those early meetings is that this needs to be highly distributed. It needs to be highly networked. The population needs to be educated. And so, you know, the easiest mandate to put to all of you in the room is that we need a level of computational and algorithmic literacy in the population ASAP, right? That's just far and unsimple, obvious. That is what it means to start talking about, you know, media literacy in the 21st century. But part of that is also the ability to understand how you're being a part of the system and messing with it. Because, you know, when people start to, you know, have to encounter these materials, they have to figure out how to question, how to move across it, and how to manipulate it right back. And that's one of the reasons I go back to loving the teenagers, because they manipulate it right back. They think it's just a funny game. But it's one of the reasons why at a political level we are seeing it play out in different environments. I'm least concerned about it here. I'm more concerned, I mean, the media is being more of a manipulator right now. Traditional legacy TV media is more of a manipulator right now than anything internet related. As any of you can have fun turning on cable TV right now, can see, but it will get more sophisticated. The question is how it will play out across the population differently. But I expect different elements.
Since we started late, I think we still probably have time for some one or two questions.
Are you on the WebEx?
We have a question.
Do we have a question on the WebEx? We can ask if there's a question on the WebEx.
Okay. From online audience?
Yeah.
So do you have a question from the online audience?
She would come on and say that.
Okay.
Okay, we haven't got any questions from the online audience. So the last question.
Enjoy your talk. Appreciate it. But the manipulator went the most apocalyptic and euphoric. You know, the both extremes from your view of society as you developed your research.
You know, I think probably a lot of it is how we actually manage to get the data together. We manage to get the data together to actually understand a lot of biology. Like the possibility of precision medicine is a true possibility. Not the one that we're doing this right now. The possibility of really doing personalized learning, these kinds of things to me are moonshots. They're things I really want to see. And right now we're going to live in a lot of land of vaporware to get there, and that kills me, but like the possibility there is still like
so strong, it's only one of the other. The possibility of rapid fire inequality, a huge social consequence as we deal with different disruptions, climate change, for example. The political lack of political wherewithal to actually be part of a meaningful society is what scares the shit out of them. The more that we are worried about our own position within society, the more we can't listen and engage others. And so as we start to see that level of fear and anxiety, which can be fueled so easily, which technology gives us to in a place, technology invites fear and anxiety like none other, the more I see us tearing each other to shreds in new ways. And that's where I sort of reside and worry. What I want to do is push past that fear and get to a much more complicated understanding of consequence. I want to hold consequence very dear and true for a lot of the research that we do. I want to make sense of it. I want it to be a reminder. I want history to be a reminder as we advance and as we progress. And part of what I struggle with as a researcher is how to get other people to do it without just trying to resist or stop advancement, but to use it to drive and make a commitment to it. And that's what I really struggle with. Because I do believe in data. I do believe in the possibility of doing meaningful analytics. I do believe in the advancement of science to pursue a lot of these questions. I just don't know that bureaucratically we're going to do it in a way that is actually beneficial to the population as a whole, and that's clear. So that's sort of where I come down to. And that's one of the reasons why, like, you know, when I look at NSF, like, you guys are going to push the forefront of a lot of this research. You push it responsibly. Please. Nice.
So, Dana, thank you so much for taking your time and traveling to NSF. And on behalf of my NSF colleagues, we appreciate your efforts and thoughts sharing with us. Thank you so much.
That concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect. Thank you for your participation.